outside looking in on Ferguson, Missouri, today, Thursday, August 14th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A foreign journalist on the streets in Ferguson tries to explain the violence to his readers.
The stark disparity that they're seeing really has surprised people, that this is the United States, the richest country in the world, and yet this is happening on the streets.
Plus, her mother's Israeli, her dad's Palestinian. Holiday get-togethers were actually less tricky than you'd think.
Even though these two families hold bitterly opposing political views, they have been in rooms with each other, talking and hugging and sharing food.
And we traveled to Kurdistan by way of Nashville.
This is actually considered Little Kurdistan, USA. You have the mosque here in the center, and to the right you have bakeries, shops, and markets.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. If I say militarization, you may be thinking Iraq. That also seemed to be what was on President Obama's mind when he stepped to the mic today while vacationing.
First of all, we continue to make progress in carrying out our targeted military operations in Iraq.
But Obama also had another violent place in his thoughts today.
Second, I want to address something that's been in the news over the last couple of days, and that's the situation in Ferguson, Missouri.
Today on The World, we're talking militarization, not in Iraq, but in Ferguson, Missouri, where we caught up with a U.S. correspondent for The Guardian newspaper in London, John Swain. I asked him how he was covering the aftermath of the police shooting of Michael Brown, the 18-year-old African-American killed on Saturday.
The way I explain it is that after several years at war overseas, the United States has begun, as it scales down those efforts, transferring and sometimes selling military equipment and hardware to regional police forces. And we might not until now have actually seen the result of that in full beam. And it's kind of shocking when it does come into view like this.
Wow, that's pretty stark. I mean, what's happening in Ferguson is not a war, but many are using war analogies to describe what's going on there. I even saw a headline today that read Baghdad, USA. You accept that, it sounds like.
It's not a war, you know, let's stress that. But some of the equipment being used by the police is military equipment. There are stun grenades. There's tear gas grenades. They are carrying assault rifles. They're driving these huge armored trucks, atop which police officers with sniper rifles and night vision goggles are perched with their guns trained on protesters. And so for a lot of these protesters that I spoke to last night, they do feel like they're in some sort of urban war zone. And the thing they keep stressing is that this is not sending them back to their houses. This is angering them and getting them back out in the streets.
Who have you been speaking with in Ferguson? What are they telling you?
Mostly I've been talking to people who live near where Michael Brown was shot, people who've been out in the protests, people who last night were kind of crouched with me behind buildings and trees and posts while gas canisters were fired down these residential streets that we were sitting in. And obviously sometimes they're too concerned about getting out of the way of gas to talk, but when they do talk, some of them have been saying pretty shocking things. They've been talking about how this is, you know, a battle between these young, predominantly African-American residents and the older, predominantly white police force, and that this is a battle that's going to continue.
Yeah, how does the racial component that a lot of U.S. media are clearly picking up on, how does that fold into your coverage? Because there was a similar thing that happened in Tottenham in North London in 2011, a 29-year-old black man shot by police.
Well, the racial component definitely seems to be playing a role here. People bring it up when I talk to them, you know, unprompted. They say, first of all, they're angry about the death of one of their friends. But secondarily, they're angry about their treatment at the hands of this police force, 94% of which is white, when 67%, I think, of the population in this small town is black, and many are sort of disadvantaged and poor. And so people keep bringing this up, that this is a white authority force using these heavy weapons against a black group of young men. And it seems to be an important part.
Is that the kind of thing that readers back in the UK are asking you about? And are you getting responses from your coverage?
The responses I'm getting from people in the UK is just startling bafflement, if you like. The images are obviously so powerful of these cops in army khaki with assault rifles, with goggles, with helmets, facing down in their trucks these young guys with you know, balaclavas to guard their mouths from gas. The stark disparity that they're seeing and what's been unleashed here really has surprised people, that this is the United States, that, you know, the world's leading superpower, the richest country in the world, and yet this is happening on the streets.
That was John Swain with the Guardian newspaper reporting from Ferguson. Yeah, those pictures John talks about are pretty scary. The gear looks like something the military would use in Iraq or Afghanistan. That intrigued us, so we got in touch with G.W. Schultz to find out more. He's a Homeland Security reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting, and he told the world that the current militarization of local police departments started after 9/11.
So after September 11th, Congress rushed to flood state and local governments with federal dollars to protect themselves against threats from terrorism. But since terrorism events are psychically a huge blow, but they're very rare, a lot of communities had a difficult time figuring out how to spend that money, right? So money is everything from Washington. If Washington designates money for a certain purpose, suddenly everyone's going to decide that they have a reason to spend that money. So if Washington says we have a counterterrorism problem in this country, we're going to give you billions of dollars to confront it, state and local communities will come up with a threat that arguably maybe didn't exist prior to September 11th, let's say. And that's one of the problems with public safety since 9/11 is we've earmarked a lot of money for counterterrorism purposes. So suddenly everybody had a counterterrorism problem. We suddenly had a whole lot of money to spend on an issue that was, to this day, well over a decade after 9/11, that we're still struggling to define.
The weapons and the police in Ferguson have people referring to the town as Fergustan, and you get these surreal videos of police patrolling through the streets there like it's a war zone. Last year, during the manhunt for the Boston bombers, I mean, local law enforcement didn't need to make up a threat. It was clear. But we saw how militarized things had become locally. How does it actually impact the public when local police look and act like an army?
All right, that's an extremely important question, because at the end of the day, what you're going to hear from police departments is they're going to say, we need to protect our people. Officer safety matters. No one wants to see cops getting killed. So who wants to strip down a police department from protective gear if it's available to them, especially if the DOD doesn't have a need for certain types of equipment anymore and is able to give them to cash-strapped law enforcement agencies? But again, optically, for some of these agencies, when they end up on the front page in the wake of a big story like this, if you're head to toe in lots of very thick protective gear, you can radiate an image of being in a war zone in a country that's very unsettled by that. And that's a problem.
From the police perspective, do they really believe like a Kenyan mall shooting could happen at any moment?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Charles Ramsey, who's the head of the Philadelphia Police Department, used to head up the D.C. Police Department. Yes. I mean, even though Ramsey and others will accept that these are highly unlikely events, but if you're in a position of leading the police department in D.C. or Philly or New York or L.A. or Chicago, if you're unprepared for events like that, and if it happens, your legacy is going to be defined by the fact that you were perceived as not being prepared for that event. That's how a lot of law enforcement officials think in the United States.
What sort of feeling do you get when you're around the police officers who are all suited up in this armor and these heavy weapons?
Well, I mean, there's the American in me that's a little unsettled by it, but I also interact with police a lot through my job. So I know that these individuals don't wake up each day and set out to violate people's civil liberties. There's a lot of cops in the United States, thousands, who didn't become police officers to ruin people's lives. They're well-intentioned. That doesn't change the fact, though, that police are really struggling with their identity in the last couple of days. A lot of Americans are really unsure how to react to Missouri and are, with that said, still upset with the shooting. And this won't be the last one, I can tell you that.
G.W. Schultz, a reporter at the Center for Investigative Reporting, joining us from Station KUT in Austin, Texas. Thanks very much, G.W.
Thank you, sir.
As the deadly Ebola crisis continues to rage, we thought of our friend Dr. Paul Farmer. He's battled lots of modern plagues, AIDS in rural Haiti, drug-resistant tuberculosis in the slums of Peru. Farmer was in Sierra Leone a few weeks ago for a conference. He told us that when he returned to his current base, Rwanda...
My temperature was taken with a handheld device at the airport. If I had come in here with a fever from Sierra Leone, I would have been placed in isolation.
Farmer sees checking airplane passengers for fevers as a positive sign that some countries in Africa are starting to create proactive healthcare systems. But he says a lot more investment is needed.
Building those systems takes significant investment. Of course, many of us have long argued that not building them is far more costly.
The odds of winning this war right now seem very dim, despite some somewhat positive news from Doctors Without Borders that they've been able to keep more than 150 patients from dying with Ebola. But, I mean, we're talking basic systems here, real fundamental stuff. What do you see as the way forward?
We're not talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of expenditures, even though we've spent that kind of money on many foolish endeavors that are not going to save lives. So the good news is that we know how to build health systems from the ground up, that is, with community health workers, with clinics, and with hospitals for those who are critically ill.
As a doctor, Paul Farmer, it's got to be distressing for you to see the medical community in places like Liberia so decimated, small number of doctors to begin with, and now several of them are dead from Ebola. Are you concerned that the international medical assistance may just not be willing to expose themselves to this major risk?
Yeah, I work with airborne diseases like drug-resistant tuberculosis or tuberculosis, and there's ample reason, you know, to be cautious. But the good news is there are always people willing to confront deadly epidemics like this. Community health workers, who almost never get remembered, could and should be the front line against epidemics like this. But, you know, they need the support that all of us need if we're going to be healthcare providers. And that support, again, requires tools for diagnosis, for care, and for self-protection. I think if we are willing to invest in these systems, we'll always find people willing to take risks to help serve the rest of humanity.
Since you were in Sierra Leone when the outbreak was happening, I'm curious to know what surprised you about the ability or inability of the medical community there to respond to the outbreak.
I wasn't surprised by courageous doctors, nurses, officials. I wasn't surprised by that. I've seen that everywhere. I wasn't surprised by how underfunded and run down the public facilities, including the main hospital, were, because I've seen that kind of neglect in places across the world. And I wasn't surprised by the awareness that many of those professionals had. They knew what was coming. Indeed, my colleagues there predicted almost down to the day when the first cases would show up in the city. What did surprise me was how rapidly the rest of the world came to see that this was a serious problem. 30 years ago, I mentioned 40 years ago, when the first epidemics of Ebola were described, you know, it was sort of a flash in the pan. Suddenly it was news and then it was forgotten. You know, it's my hope that there'll be some sustained attention to this and that we will really try and build a global equity plan.
As a doctor and somebody who focuses on these links between disease and poverty, is Ebola something that you're just going to be drawn into, whether you like it or not, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's a privilege to help think through these problems. Like, how do we build health systems that can reach from a village, a rural village, into a town and into a city? How do we build systems that can prevent, whenever possible, epidemics like this, but also systems that can care for those who are critically ill? And I just hope to be productive and supportive of those frontline workers who are trying to prevent these cases, and for those who are ill, to take good care of them. I mean, that is, after all, our job as doctors and nurses, to take care of the sick.
Dr. Paul Farmer is a professor at Harvard Medical School and the founder of Partners in Health. Thanks, as always.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Still ahead on The World, sending out the welcome wagon to young migrants arriving in Texas on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. For author Claire Hajjaj, the divide between Jew and Arab isn't just something she watches on TV. It's deeply personal. Hajjaj's father is Palestinian. Her mother's family is Jewish. Claire grew up living with that divide. Her parents raised her in various spots around the Mideast and in rural England. She now lives in Beirut and has a new novel out called Ishmael's Oranges.
My mother really carries the story of the Jewish people, if you like, in the 20th century in her family. She comes from a very conservative Jewish family. They are a family of pogrom survivors. Her sister was adopted off the Kindertransport, which was the train that brought Jewish children to the UK, fleeing from Nazi Germany. So she has been watching Gaza, as have we all, with a deep despair, but also a feeling of anxiety and tension. This is causing more anti-Semitism and even anger that the Jewish position is not understood. It's been an extremely, extremely difficult time.
So contrast that with your father's side of the family, which has very different origins and had a very different reaction to the violence in Gaza and Israel.
Well, I've been speaking to my cousins over the last few weeks, and they've been out in the streets of London marching. For them, there is no justification.
And they're Palestinian, your father's side of the family.
They are Palestinian.
Yeah.
My father's family are Palestinian, absolutely. Now, these are Palestinians who, they suffer, I think, from a kind of a survivor guilt because they're in the UK. They're not sitting there in the West Bank. They're not in Gaza. They're not in Lebanon, where I now live, where Palestinians do live in camps and have a very, very difficult life. And they feel, therefore, but they carry the memory of the Nakba, the catastrophe of 1948, as they call it, inside them. They feel that they should be living in their old home. And they want to stand up and speak out for Palestinians who are now there on the front line of what they see as the cause. So for them, it's a very simple case that these are victimized people. The Israelis are brutal oppressors and people are being murdered in their hundreds and the world is not speaking out. They also cannot see the fear and the grief and the concern and the historical paralysis, if you like, of the other side.
And then there's you, Claire, the issue of these two people. How does all this settle out in you? Is it complicated?
It is complicated in that I love both of these families. I love my families, and I have a very deep empathy for both perspectives. I can feel the pain of my father's family and see the grief that they suffer. They've lived in Jordan, they've lived in Lebanon, they live here, and they mourn. I can see the grief of my mother's family, the pain of the daughters of my aunt who's now dead, who know that her mother lost her brother, baby brother, and family in Auschwitz. The people who remember carry the stories of fleeing from Russia, who see themselves being bombed by people who they believe want them dead. I can really feel their suffering, but at the same time, it's intensely frustrating because it's very, very hard to take people away from the emotional response of their own positions and to get them to look at it from perspective, how do we now make this stop? This is no longer about righting the wrongs of the past. There are some wrongs that cannot be righted, no matter how much we want them to be. How do we move beyond this? That's very hard to do, and it's very, very tough to be in the middle. It's a painful place to be.
Well, let's unpack how you personally got to this point, Claire.
Yeah.
How did your parents meet?
My parents met in the 60s at university. My mother was down, I think, tasting freedom probably for the first time from a very conservative family. And my father was an immigrant, a young immigrant who'd come to the country. He'd stayed in Israel post-48. And he'd come barely speaking English, barely having any money, and try to make his way. And when he met my mother, I mean, my mother was a Jewess who wore a Star of David and
And this is in the UK, yeah?
This is in the UK in the 60s, in the Summer of Love in 1967. And they saw something in each other, a similarity. And that similarity in spirit, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I still think it was a victory to a certain extent, even though they eventually had to divorce. It created three children who still hold the middle ground, and that's a triumph of a sort. But they married each other with their families standing by, I think, in intense anxiety. And there was definitely, it wasn't sort of nobody was threatening to kill each other, but there was a lot of anxiety about how can this possibly work.
And all this, as you said, is transpiring in the Summer of Love, very evocative mm-hmm. moment. Do you think they were trying to rewrite tribal hatred?
I think that when my parents met, unraveling the history of 48 could not possibly be more tangled than unraveling the history of my parents' first meeting. But still, I think that from what I've heard from both of them is that they were just two people who fell in love and who saw something in each other that reminded them of things they wanted to see in themselves. And that is fine when it happens between two people who share similar backgrounds, but very, very complicated between two people who come from different backgrounds, and even more so between two people whose families would normally see themselves as enemies. But what I have experienced in my growing up is that even though these two families hold bitterly opposing political views and could never have a discussion about Israel together, at the same time, they have been in rooms with each other, talking and hugging and sharing food and discussing children and loves and divorces and deaths in a way that is really quite remarkable. Remarkable in a reminder that these people do not have to be enemies. It is not destined that they are so. I saw them sharing far more than separated them, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great conclusion. I'm just wondering, when you were a kid, what was your earliest memory of a discussion in your family about the Mideast? And was it civil or was it tense?
My earliest memory of the discussion about the Middle East and my first realization of what kind of strange predicament we were in as a family came when I was five. And I was in the car with my mother. We were living in the Middle East at that time. And we were driving along and my grandmother was coming to visit her mother. And she said to me, "Now, Claire, I just must tell you, you're not allowed to use your granny's name." My grandma's last name was Shapiro. Mm. And I asked her why. And then she explained to me in very simple terms, as you do for a child, that the Jews and the Palestinians can't agree on who should live in this land. And they are fighting and they get very angry about it. And so I asked her, "So when will they stop fighting?" And she was silent for a minute, I remember. And then she said, "I think soon." Hmm. And it took me years to understand that that was a kind lie.
And now you have a young daughter. What are your hopes for her as she comes to grips with this Jewish and Palestinian heritage that she now has?
Well, I want her to understand both. I, as much as is possible, I can't wrap her in a single flag, and I know that that's difficult for different members of my families. I've had a lot of arguments over the last 3 weeks, and it's been tough. Sometimes I've had to hold my tongue because there are some things that cannot be changed by ranting. If only others could see the same way. I mean, you cannot change somebody's narrative by dismissing and denying it. And they look at my daughter and they also wonder, who is she going to be? Is she going to be a Zionist? Is she going to be a Jew hater? People do wonder. For me, she's going to be somebody, I very much hope, who understands her heritage, who can empathize with both, who looks for points of connection rather than points of division, and just is a human being without having to fly one flag or another. That is what I would hope for her, and that is how I would raise her.
Author Claire Hajjaj lives in Beirut. Her new book is called Ishmael's Oranges. Claire, thank you very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up, during the war in Gaza, Israeli and Hamas TV run each other's news programs. Seriously, it's kind of a know thine enemy sort of thing. That's ahead, just after the headlines. This is PRI. I'm Marco Werman. The Islamic State has set up what it calls a caliphate in a chunk of the Middle East. But what does that really mean?
What they really want is to hearken back to some imagined glorious period where the Muslim community was the number one political and military power on this planet.
More on that just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. From a three-day Gaza ceasefire to a five-day Gaza ceasefire, if Israel and Hamas keep up like this, it might start looking like progress. Meantime, indirect talks continue to broker a long-term ceasefire. Even indirect talks are better than no talks. Daniel Estrin reports now from Jerusalem on one very public line of communication and a very direct line that's been taking place on television.
It started as an experiment in 2012 during the last round of fighting between Israel and Hamas. Israel's leading TV news station, Channel 2, was broadcasting the war live, while veteran Middle East affairs commentator Ehud Ya'ari sat in the Israeli studio near Jerusalem. A large screen behind him projected a live feed of Hamas TV from Gaza to show Israeli audiences how Hamas viewed the war. Turned out Hamas TV was doing the exact same thing. A Palestinian commentator in the studio was broadcasting with a live feed of Israeli Channel 2 behind him.
So at one point I decided, why shouldn't I try to talk to him?
This is Ehud Ya'ari, the Israeli TV commentator. He's a 69-year-old veteran journalist with neatly combed white hair. And do you get what he was attempting to do? The two TV stations were broadcasting each other live, a kind of know-thy-enemy approach. But instead of just observing the enemy, Ya'ari engaged him on live television. At first, he caught the Hamas anchor off guard. No one expected there to be a conversation. But after a few moments of silence, the Hamas anchor began speaking to Ya'ari in Hebrew. I've watched you for years, ever since I was in Israeli jail, the anchor said. You are very good. Thank you, Ya'ari said. And then they got talking about the war.
And they were trying to tell me, but we are winning. We have the upper hand, etc. So, yeah, I said to them, you know that you're not going to score a victory.
Their chat lasted less than 2 minutes, but it opened an unprecedented public dialogue between Israel and Hamas. During the recent conflict, Ya'ari says his TV station and the Hamas TV station often carried each other live, and he tried to talk to the Hamas anchor. He says it worked twice, but other times, the Hamas anchor answered and said he wouldn't speak to Zionists. It was still gripping television.
Because at one point, what you had on screen, both on Hamas and on our screen, was my own picture quadrupled. We were carrying them, carrying us, carrying them. So it created a very, psychedelic picture.
Ya'ari is a journalist, a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and also something of an intelligence operative. In this tiny office walled with television screens, he and his staff monitor some 300 TV channels from across the Middle East. And he says he speaks almost daily with senior Hamas officials who give him messages for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
They will very often say to me, well, why don't you say to Mr. Netanyahu so-and-so? Or why don't you pass the word that ABC?
Sometimes he'll communicate these messages to Israeli government officials, but he says he's not Hamas's mailman. Deborah Kamin, a Tel Aviv-based journalist who covers Israeli media, wrote about Ya'ari for The Atlantic. She says Ya'ari's on-air dialogues with Hamas anchors have served an important role.
We don't have any sort of access to those negotiation rooms, and we don't even really know what's going on there. But if we're on our couches watching the news, we can see exactly what Ehud Ya'ari is saying to the anchor in Gaza, And maybe that conversation is even more important because it involves the public.
Ya'ari downplays all of this. Even off-screen, he says, his direct communication hasn't brought Hamas closer to publicly recognizing Israel or giving up armed conflict. But he says that doesn't stop him from talking to them. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
Actually, talking to the other side during a conflict may be the only hope for ending it. In Iraq, the fighters of the Islamic State are doing their communicating, mainly through bullets and violence. There has been just one video from the fearsome leader of the Islamic State, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and one thing that stood out was his desire to create a whole new geopolitical fact on the ground, a literal Islamic State, or caliphate. It's an ancient and abstract idea, so to get a handle on what it means, I spoke with Islam scholar Tariq Masood, an associate professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Forgive my ignorance. Is a caliphate something that's actually mandated in the Quran? I mean, why is there a need for there to be a caliphate, or is there no need?
Oh, well, it's not mandated in the Quran, but there is obviously a precedent going back to early Islamic history. Remember, the Prophet Muhammad wasn't just the messenger of God, he was also the temporal leader of the community of Muslims. And so when the Prophet Muhammad died, his best friend and son-in-law became the caliph, the successor to the Prophet Muhammad. And basically there was a caliph, a leader of the entire Muslim community, somebody called the commander of the faithful, all the way until 1924. So it's something that's deeply embedded in the Muslim historical experience. And after the caliphate was dissolved in 1924, lots of Muslims have yearned to bring it back.
What then is a caliphate supposed to be? I mean, do you have an ideal caliphate?
I'm not sure there's an ideal caliphate. I think if you were to inject these young men with sodium pentothal, these people who join the caliphate, and ask them, what do you really want? What do you really want out of ISIS? They wouldn't tell you necessarily something about the application of Islamic law. I mean, that might be part of it. But what they really want is to hearken back to some imagined glorious period where the Muslim community was the number one political and military power on this planet, where the Muslim empire extended all the way from Spain to the other side of the world. That's what they really look for, because they feel today Muslims are weak, divided. American and Western troops have free reign of Muslim lands. Muslim homes are not secure anywhere. And of course, the pictures out of Gaza, I think, just further reinforce this feeling that some of these people have, that what's needed is for Muslims to unite. And once Muslims unite, then these kinds of things, these kinds of tragedies will not happen to them. I think that's what that's what these people are about.
So are Muslims around the world going, wow, Iraq and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, they've got they're capturing those glory days of Islam?
So I think absolutely not. I mean, I think, first of all, the ISIS is not, we're reading about a lot of people joining ISIS, but it's still a fringe group. In fact, even among radical Islamists who might be most hospitable to this idea that you've got to resurrect the caliphate, there's a huge amount of disagreement. So no, I absolutely don't think there's any kind of consensus that this represents the caliphate.
And yet in London, on good old Oxford Street, there are people handing out leaflets in support of the Islamic State. So who are they?
Yes. So those are basically supporters of a fringe group in London called Al Muhajirun that is led by a quite colorful and insane character named Anjum Chaudhry. So, look, there have always been people like this for whom, again, support of the idea of ISIS is perhaps striking a blow at what they see as Western imperialism. But again, I don't think this means that, Muslims in London or any Western capital are thinking about migrating to Iraq to live under the Islamic State.
So maybe not support for the caliphate as perceived by the Islamic State, but are there Muslims who do think that there ought to be a caliphate somewhere in the world?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. But again, once you start interrogating the vision for the caliphate, you see there are very different ones. So I'd say, look, the vast majority of Muslims are pretty much happy with the nation states that they live under. And, if you ask them, do you support the caliphate? even those who said yes probably just think of it as a kind of notional terms, not as a kind of real government that would actually unite Muslims from, you know, Indonesia to Morocco.
Tariq Masood at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, thanks very much for unpacking this for us.
Thank you, Marco.
Let's come back from the Middle East and go to the U.S.-Mexico border. No caliphate there, but there's another story keeping us busy. The U.S. Border Patrol is also pretty busy down there. They're trying to decide which migrant families from Central America will get sent to detention facilities and which will be allowed to live with relatives in the U.S. as they await their day in immigration court. Most will seek asylum or special protection for their children. For families who are suddenly released, that can be exciting, but also frightening and overwhelming. The World's Jason Margolis reports on one effort in McAllen, Texas, to help these migrants adjust to their first few minutes on U.S. soil.
Border Patrol agents generally drop off families at the downtown McAllen bus station near the border. There, the families wait for a few hours, perhaps overnight, for their bus to Houston, New York, Kansas City, or wherever. When the numbers of migrants waiting at the bus station rose this summer, the Sacred Heart Catholic Church here began inviting them in for a few hours. Brenda Riojas with the Diocese of Brownsville shows me around the church, now doubling as a temporary shelter.
It's a place where mothers and children can come and rest for a little bit. It's a place for them to catch their breath.
Many of these families had been traveling for 10, 20, or 30 days before getting here.
We see them come in. They're exhausted. They're hungry. They're a little lost, a little disoriented, because basically they've just been dropped off at the bus station and they just know that they need to buy their tickets, but they don't really know how to navigate the bus system, that there's going to be bus transfers, etc. So here we also give them a sheet that says, I don't speak English, please help me find my bus.
Some days they help 40 people, other days closer to 200.
Volunteers, the trolley is pulling up. Be ready to greet our visitors, please.
You'll want to get this on tape. They clap. Everyone claps as they come in. And notice their faces. Some of them smile. Some of them become very shy. Some of them break into tears because it's the first time that they've been welcomed. Bienvenida.
Each family is paired with a volunteer like Susan Joyner. She drove down from Austin with a church group.
Why did I come? I wanted to serve. We love children. And as soon as we heard the need, I mean, we looked at each other and said, we're going.
When Joyner's family is off having a shower, she goes shopping for them, digging through piles of donated clothing. Joyner and some of the other volunteers take this assignment very seriously.
Look how small these are, though. Get them some nice jeans.
Yeah, we need jeans. Oh, jeans. Okay.
After the family members are clean, Joyner gives them their new wardrobes.
And then everybody says, muy bonito, and they smile, and their dignity is restored.
Then it's time for a warm meal. I sit with Bilma from Honduras. She eats with her three children, two sons and a daughter, ages 12, 14, and 16. Their father is dead.
Muy duro. Ratos caminando y ratos en autobús.
Bilma tells me how her journey took 3 weeks, walking, taking buses, and then a raft across the Rio Grande. They turned themselves in to U.S. authorities and were put into a Border Patrol detention center. She says the worst part of the trip was when Border Patrol put her two young sons in a separate cell.
Una noche, varios hombres me abrieron la puerta, queriendo como asaltarme.
Bilma says she left Honduras because gang members beat her up, tried to rob her, then take advantage of her teenage daughter. She says her two sons fought them off. She says the gang threatened revenge. With few options, she set out north to be with her sister in Dallas. Brenda Riojas says she hears stories like this every day. To her, Bilma and her children aren't here illegally. They're refugees.
And for those who think the solution is to send them back immediately, how can you send someone who is fleeing a fire back into that fire? They're coming here for a chance to live.
After their meals, the families head into a large tent with a generator blasting air conditioning. It's 100 degrees plus outside.
Técnicamente, legalmente, ahí los pueden detener.
Carlos García is one of about a dozen immigration attorneys volunteering to make legal presentations.
So I'm telling them right now that there's two processes. One is that they have to show up with a deportation officer as soon as the date that they gave them. And then the other one is they're going to show up in immigration court. So it's a little bit confusing.
Garcia is thorough and patient. Most of the women don't ask any questions. A few tell me later, though, they didn't really understand everything he was saying. It's a lot to take in, and they only have a few weeks to figure it out. A little later, some of the families take naps. For others, it's time to head to the bus station. I went and found Vilma from Honduras, who I met during lunch. I asked her how she felt.
Mucho mejor.
Much better, she says.
Estoy nerviosa.
I'm nervous, though, she adds. Understandable. Moments later, it's time to board the bus. She walks off with her three children and a tote bag filled with donated food and drinks. A church volunteer gives her a kiss on the cheek, and Vilma disappears behind the bus's tinted glass windows. The volunteer turns and heads back to the church to help a new family. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
See how the Sacred Heart Church volunteers welcome tired and overwhelmed migrants in Texas. Jason posted some pictures from his trip there. They're at PRI.org. Just ahead, a trip to Kurdistan by way of Nashville. That's here on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Emmylou, the Grand Ole Opry, Music City, USA. That's Nashville, right? How about mosques and pita bread? That's also Nashville. You see, Nashville, Tennessee is playing a small role in Middle East politics as home to America's largest Kurdish community. The World's Monica Campbell went exploring in Nashville's Little Kurdistan.
First, meet one of my guides.
My name is Rimzia Suleiman.
She's 29 and a community organizer here. In the late 80s, her family fled Iraq's Kurdish region, escaping Saddam Hussein's genocide.
And we actually were on the run for several years. Actually, a church in Nashville sponsored our family and have been in Nashville since 91.
Suleiman and I are here off a long street on Nashville's southeast side, in front of what looks like a typical strip mall. But it's more than that.
This is actually considered Little Kurdistan, USA. You have the mosque here in the center, and to the right you have bakeries, shops, and markets.
The community's roots go back to the late 70s. That's when the first wave of Kurds started fleeing Iraq after an uprising against Saddam Hussein failed. The U.S. helped settle the refugees in Nashville. It was affordable. There were entry-level jobs. And then a big wave of Kurdish refugees arrived in the 90s, and more Kurds arrived to Nashville. Today, the city's Kurdish community is America's biggest, totaling about 13,000. When I visit, it's Friday, so I go to the mosque with Suleiman during afternoon prayer.
Walaikum assalam. We'll actually go into the woman's side and for the remainder of the service.
Praise Allah, praise the God.
While the imam delivers the sermon to the men in the other room, a flat-screen TV transmits his service to the women here while kids run around. After, there's catching up. People head out for food. A Kurdish man sells watermelons from the back of his truck. And Suleiman shows me around with one of her friends, Druth Kokoyi. Her family is also Kurdish and fled war. They got to the U.S. as refugees in the late 90s. We all go to a market and head to a large bakery tucked away in the back. Kokoyi has seen how the demand for a taste from home has grown here.
It was just one little small hot closet almost where you would go in and out just to get the bread.
Sabri Abdullah runs the place and is packing up bread in paper bags. He got here in 1993 and tells me about what he makes.
Kurdish bread is Arabic, pita bread, Barbary, Irani, Samon.
In the bakery, there's a wall lined with ovens, including a tandoor, a large drum-shaped oven. Several workers are kneading dough into long flatbreads. A woman, who only speaks Kurdish, creates small mounds of dough. She then sticks the dough to the sides of the tandoor to bake and uses tongs to pull the bread just as it puffs up and gets soft. In the market next door, there's another tucked away spot in a tiny side room. It's where Ibrahim Tahir sells jewelry. It's pretty clear what's in demand. Gold for weddings, anniversaries. There's glittering necklaces, bracelets, and traditional huge gold belts with dangling coins.
It's also known as the WWF Championship belt. And the coins also wrap around the waist.
As you can see, this is me shaking a little bit. This is the noise it would make.
This is 350 gram, and it's about $15,000.
Tahir, the shopkeeper, says some Kurds here still like buying gold. It feels safer than putting savings in a bank.
But the gold, you can carry it. You're going to need it one time in your life. So you better have it with you when you need it. You don't have a banking system back in Kurdistan or in Iraq. Even if you have them, you're not safe to put them in there.
And Kurds here in Nashville often debate whether to carry cash or gold when they make visits back home. Kurdistan is never far from the minds of these residents. Days after I leave Nashville, tensions rise in northern Iraq. I give Suleiman a call. It's all hitting home. She's already attended memorials in the community for loved ones, Peshmerga fighters who have been killed back home.
There's definitely mourning. I think our community is on the edge. We are concerned about the safety and security of all of our loved ones. But I think it's a little more difficult that we're so far away and we can't be there.
She's leading a call for volunteers in Nashville to help sort and pack donations for a humanitarian aid campaign. They're calling it All for Kurdistan. For the world, I'm Monica Campbell, Nashville.
So what takes you home? We just heard about that flatbread from the Kurdish bakery, so maybe it's a certain food or maybe a sound that reminds you of home. Let us know. Just head to pri.org/justlikehome. That's pri.org/justlikehome. Also, listen in tomorrow. Monica's got another story from Nashville. This one's about the city's first Kurdish-American cop. His uncle's a high-ranking Kurdish Peshmerga fighter, and he kind of wishes he could join him.
I have that feeling that I want to defend my country. And me becoming a police officer, I feel like I'm defending and protecting the United States and the city of Nashville. And if I was back home, I would probably join the Kurdish forces.
We ride along with Officer G.A. Suleiman tomorrow on The World. Kurdistan to Nashville, adapting old traditions to the new home. You can imagine how that could affect Kurdish musical traditions. Hard to say when we'll see Kurdish stars playing at the Grand Ole Opry. Who knows? Maybe someday. I do have this really cool example of two musical traditions coming together. What you're hearing are two harps. Okay, one harp and one kora, a distant cousin of the harp from West Africa. The kora is being played by Sekou Keita from Senegal. The harp is in the hands of Welsh musician Catherine Finch. Both of them are masters of their instruments. Keita from several generations of Senegalese kora players. Finch is one of the most acclaimed harpists in the world. She even served as official harpist to Prince Charles, who knew the royal family had an official harpist. Anyway, you won't be surprised to hear that what Sekou Keita and Catherine Finch produced together is nothing short of sublime. Sekou Keita and Katrin Finch on kora and harp, respectively. Their new CD is full of their call-and-response conversations on those instruments. It's a pretty remarkable collaboration. Tomorrow we'll have more music and more stories from around the world here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being with us.
World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. The PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.